History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we sure learn a lot, don't we? We're educated, we're entertained, often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Every year when the middle of February rolls around, I try to focus you back on something that happened this time of year. 77 years ago now, the Japanese-American community across our country holds a day of remembrance. Because Executive Order 9066 happened, President Roosevelt issuing that decree in 1942 in the wake of the attack on Pearl Harbor, and it changed so many lives. We're going to hear from a man whose life was changed back then and hear how he overcame all of that today. 92-year-old Robert Uesaka of Clovis, California, our guest today. You weren't born here, you're born in Southern California, but very young age, your family moved to Arizona. And you're the youngest of four kids. Why did your family have to move out to Arizona?
My dad contracted a severe case of asthma, and the weather there was not good for his health, so the doctor advised him to move to a drier climate, which was Arizona. So he visited Arizona for a couple of weeks, and when he came back, he was in glowing health. So he just rapidly picked up all his belongings and with a family moved to Arizona.
So what was that like? In the 1930s, people say Salt River now, and they think of the baseball complexes for spring training. But what was out there in the 1930s, and what were your memories growing up in a farming family?
Well, we went there in 1927, and I was only 1 year old, so that period is, I can't remember. But then back in the 30s, Depression era was pretty tough. People were always in need. And growing up in that era, you know, your philosophy on life is much different than those of the young people today. Save what you could and utilize what you have. That was the mode of living in that era.
Well, and I'm wondering if maybe you have some examples of that, that maybe young people today would say, really? Did they really do that? Do you look back on some things that you did that didn't seem like a big deal then but might be now?
Well, being in, you know, in that era, as children, we had much more freedom than the children of today. We didn't have the fears that most of the parents have for their children today. We had more peace, and nobody bothered us as we roamed the countryside. We always lived in the country, and we're always a farming family. So basically, we didn't suffer as much as far as food and the bare necessities as some of the people in the cities. Most of our basic needs were always there, so we didn't suffer as much as some of the other families might have.
What all did you grow on your farm?
With strawberries, cantaloupe, and, produce and berries, most of the stuff that truck farming in those days.
But since you were the youngest, they didn't make you do anything around the farm, right?
No, I was the youngest. You know, in the 30s, I was only preteen, so there's not much I could do. But I remember how hard it was for not only our family, but for everybody. Like farm labor was 10 cents an hour. And, they worked 7 days a week, 10 hours a day. They'd take $7 home. And still, they made a bare living with that. So things were difficult. But as a child, you don't realize how difficult it is for the parents.
Well, and if you can remember that child, that young boy, I'm sure you're influenced somewhat by your two older brothers and your older sister, but do you remember having ambitions, dreams, ideas of, hey, someday here's what I'm going to do?
Oh, yeah. I always wanted to become a doctor, and I was taking some of the courses and things, but then when Pearl Harbor happened and we were taking it to camps and everything, well, all that went out the window.
Well, I'd like to understand your life before that happened. Like you said, you're a teenager.
16
when Pearl Harbor happens. Going to school, had you ever experienced any kind of discrimination, or were you ever made to feel that you were different because your parents had immigrated from Japan?
Oh, yeah, constantly. You know, friends that you had prior to Pearl Harbor no longer were your friends. Everybody looked at you with a jaundiced eye. Even at home, when your telephone rang, somebody always picked up. It was party line. Somebody picked up to listen in on the conversation every time. And by law, we were restricted to not go too far from where you lived. But at the time, I was 16. So that was about the way life was at that point. But there was a lot of prejudice toward the Japanese in Arizona, Salt River Valley at that time. And there was a lot of problems.
What about before Pearl Harbor? Had you dealt with that much before, or did that really catch you off guard when that happened?
No, all this prejudice happened before Pearl Harbor. Some of the Japanese homes where people would throw homemade bombs against the house. I had a good friend that his house was bombed. They would open the gates to the irrigation water and flood your fields and stuff like that would happen. And if you had some vehicle parked near the ditch, they would push it into the ditch. Things like that. And one instance, there were five of us young, because I was a second grader at the time. They chased us. You know, they were high school kids. They chased us, and we were away from home. But we had BB guns, so we were able to get rid of them.
Well, we can laugh about it now, but I'm sure at the time, things like that were really upsetting to you. What maybe gave you stability or a sense of connection or someone to depend on when it seemed like so many people were against you?
Well, you know, not everybody. You had instances where people were, I guess, more tolerant toward us and all that. All through pre-Pearl Harbor and post-Pearl Harbor days, there were the missionaries that came from the different denominations. They were very friendly and very helpful. They brought stability in our lives. Like even after I left camp, we were in Colorado, and it was the missionaries there that really opened their doors for the evacuees and all that. So life became more normal.
What about December 7th, 1941? Do you remember how you found out what happened?
Oh, yeah. We didn't find out till later that evening because everybody was working on a Sunday to get ready for sending the produce to the market on Monday morning. So it wasn't until that evening we heard about it. At first, it was, you know, you wouldn't believe it. But then after you saw the headlines the following morning in the newspaper, it became a reality. I guess it affected each individual in a different way. Like, I was younger, so it wasn't that traumatic as it might have been for my parents. And for them, the war ended their time of being self-sufficient and everything. They were semi-invalid even before the war. But then after Pearl Harbor, their productivity was just cut off, and they never became productive after that.
Did you have to go to school the next day?
Oh, yes. We went to school until evacuation, where they had took us into camp.
Well, what was it like at school the next day, and how many Japanese-American students do you think there were in your school?
Oh, there might have been about less than a dozen. So there were instances where prejudice showed up. Like, we had one fellow that was a senior in high school. He was chosen to be king of the one of the ceremonies at the end of the school year. Well, the superintendent took that honor away from him. Of course, he didn't have to evacuate because he was on the other side of the line.
Well, explain that to me. So where you lived, there was a line of demarcation for who had to go in the camps and who could live quasi-free.
Yes, there's a main highway bisecting Salt River Valley there. Everybody who lived on the south side of that highway would evacuate first, and then those who lived on the north side would follow eventually. But then it turned out that for some reason or other, the government chose not to take them into camp. So they got to stay there while we were in camp, and they never did have to go to camp. We heard rumors that they were running out of produce, and they were mostly produce farmers, so they needed them to grow the crops.
Well, I guess I should ask you this too, because now we look in hindsight, and you know, this is something you've lived with for more than 70 years, more than 75 years, and we know that this happened, that Japanese Americans on the West Coast were forced out of their homes, that in many cases they lost everything they had, and we'll hear about your family's story. But at the time, even after Pearl Harbor, even with the discrimination you dealt with, could you ever have imagined that the government would lock you all up behind barbed wire?
Well, that never occurred to us that would ever happen. You know, the Bill of Rights and everything gives you that freedom, but then unfortunately, it can be taken away. That's what happened to us. But, you know, being 16, it doesn't hit you as hard and negatively as it would otherwise. If I were older, it would have been more serious. But then, you know, 16, you're still a kid yet, and these things really don't have a large impact on your life.
And so we have a sense of the scope of this. Before Pearl Harbor, before 9066, 3 months later, your family had this farm. How many acres do you think you were farming?
80 acres.
And your family owned that?
No. You know, my parents could never own property. They were prohibited by law and could not become citizens or own property. Even to rent the property, they had to get a third party to sign the lease. So, it was always a problem. But my dad would have liked to own property, but by law he couldn't.
Just because he was an immigrant from Japan.
Oriental.
That's what they called him then.
Yeah, from the Orient.
But he'd overcome some of those obstacles. You're leasing this land. You're farming 80 acres. As you said, that got you through the Depression with the food right there. And he was the family. You were supporting a family of six on this land. And all of that was taken away from you.
There were crops that could be harvested at that time, but then there was nobody to come forth and to buy it. So you just have to abandon it. And that's what we did. It was forced on, so you couldn't do anything about it.
And this was an incredible hardship for every Japanese-American family who got sent to a camp. In your family's case, they actually split your family apart. What happened there?
Well, my oldest brother, to conduct business, he went to the north side of the line, who had more freedom at that time. So he conducted the business for the produce being sold and all that. So he left. My dad was an enemy alien, so he was taken into a different camp by the FBI. They just came one day and told him he had to go to, and they picked him up and just took him. So that just left the three of us at home until the time we were evacuated and put into the camps.
How did you handle that as a 16-year-old, to see your father taken away from your family just like that?
Well, there's not much you can do. You wish it didn't happen, but it did, and you just have to live with it. It was hard for the older, especially for my oldest brother and sister and my mother, but they carried on the work of the farm, and we had strawberries at the time and some other things, and they would continue harvesting until we left.
When your father was taken away by the FBI, how long prior to your going to the camp was that?
Well, 2 months. I think my dad was taken in March, if I remember correctly, and we were sent to the camps in May.
And I'm sure you had no idea what to expect, but what did you find when you got to that internment camp in Poston, Arizona?
Well, initially, you know, the Arizona people, there were roughly 250 of us that were taken into the camps initially. We were sent to a CCC camp in northern Arizona, a little town called Mayer. They had a little camp there, which they enclosed and made rooms there for the families to occupy. The kitchen was there and everything, so we stayed there for a couple months, and then we were sent to Poston.
What did it feel like to be a teenager and to be locked up in this camp with these other people that, you know, you've got a few family members, maybe you know some of the other folks? What was your day-to-day life like, and what was your outlook at that point?
Well, it's an experience that, you know, like most of the people that went to camp, we knew, because the Japanese people in Arizona, there were times when we had to band together, so we knew a lot of them. As far as for myself, it wasn't difficult at all, because, you know, you got other young people that are there. We had football games and different kind of things that you did. For me, it was more like an adventure.
You were the right age for that, I guess, huh?
Sure. You know, you're more carefree, and you don't have the responsibilities of worrying about the family and all that. So, sure, you thought about your father and all that who weren't there, because only four of us went to camp. My oldest brother was in Colorado, and my dad was in the different camp, so it was a little bit difficult for that in that respect.
Were you guys able to correspond with your father at all?
Oh, yeah, you could write letters, but then everything was censored. You'd get letters with blocked out things and all that. Portions of the letter would be blocked out if they didn't want us to know where he was and all that kind of stuff. Well, it was all blocked out. And I suppose they did the same to the letters we sent to him.
Which camp was he in?
Well, there's several of them. He was in Lordsburg. He was in Crystal City. There were several of them he was shifted around to.
Did you ever understand why?
No, No, it's, you don't know what the government does with, you know, when they take people in. So you just have to be patient and wait till you get a letter from him to let you know that he's okay.
So when they moved you from that first camp in northern Arizona down to Poston, then you're in a much bigger camp with a whole lot of Japanese Americans who they had forced out of California, right?
Oh, yeah. I never knew there were so many Japanese. We had people from all over California in the western states in Poston. You know, you got to know different people. There were a lot of problems, too. But then for us younger, you know, the young guys, we had our sport programs. We had baseball teams, softball teams, and all that. So it was a lot of fun.
I've seen some photographs, and I've read a lot about baseball, particularly in that camp and neighboring camps. It probably didn't look like the baseball fields that we see in that part of the country right now, though. What can you describe for us the setting or the fields you played on, and how much of a big deal that was to have the chance to play baseball there, or how big of a distraction or outlet that was?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was one of the big outlets. You know, one of the things that without the sports and everything, you know, life in camp would have been real dull. Of course, you had your dances and church services and all that, but then sports was one of the big draws for the young guys. As far as the facilities, we had to create our own. They had empty areas in the camps, so you cleared the area and formed your own lines and created your own baseball field. And, you know, miraculously, the ball and the bats would come from someplace. Some people from outside the camp would donate it and send it in. And we have friends from Arizona that came in and visited us, and they would bring us some sports equipment, horseshoes and things like that, that they thought we might enjoy. So things like that was a bright part of what we experienced.
What position did you play?
Second base. I was a young kid, but, you know, most of the guys were older. There were a few of us younger guys on the team, but it was a lot of fun.
That experience was not unique to Mr. Uesaka. Baseball was a powerful lifeline for many in that same predicament. My friend Kari Yo Nakagawa of the Nisei Baseball Research Project has written a tremendous book about that called Diamonds in the Rough. I have a link to that online at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll hear more of Robert Uesaka's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say, I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 92-year-old Robert Uesaka of Clovis, California. He grew up in Arizona, and 77 years ago this week, he and his family had their lives changed forever by Executive Order 9066, which led to what's commonly referred to as the Japanese internment, really the incarceration of close to 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry. You heard him say playing baseball as a teenager in his camp in Poston, Arizona was a lot of fun, but I'm sure there was plenty that wasn't fun. Did you ever feel like you were in danger?
Oh, yeah, there were instances where the army came in and set up machine guns around the crowd and all that. Since I was younger than 18, I wasn't too involved in it because I didn't want kids being involved. But if you were 18 and over, you became involved. I remember that there was some dissension and there was some people that were involved in it were caught and were supposed to be taken into Phoenix to be prosecuted. But then the residents of the camp said that they're posting residents, so the people they should be judged in camp. And the army and the administration wanted them to be judged in Phoenix, go to court in Phoenix, and them taken be taken away. So that's when the army came in, and they set up machine guns and around the perimeter. But they protested night and day. The younger people, 45 and younger, had to go nighttime, and the older people went at daytime. And they surrounded the jail there and wouldn't let anybody out. And it was pretty dangerous at the time, but then they finally said that they could be prosecuted there in Arizona and in camp. So that settled the situation.
Well, and I guess this is backtracking a little bit, but I should probably include this. Even before that, you had witnessed something that told you what could happen if you resisted any of this or if you tried to get out of this government order into the camps. You saw someone who tried to avoid going in?
No, I didn't see it, but I heard of a person from Salinas. I don't know if it was rumor or truth, but we heard that he defied the order and didn't go to camp, and the army sent soldiers there and forced him to go to camp. So there was no way you could avoid it because, you were forced to register, and they knew who you were and everything. And it's surprising what the FBI knows about you and your family and your past and probably your future, too. But there was no way to evade evacuation.
And I'm sorry for bouncing around here, but we talked about baseball a little bit, and I should probably ask you, because I've announced baseball games in Cesar Uesaka Stadium in Santa Barbara. It's named for your cousin. Was he in the same camp as you guys? Was he elsewhere?
No, he was in the other camp in Arizona, Gila River, because he lived in Santa Barbara, and they were taken to a different camp. Like in Poston 1, there were people from Arizona, Bakersfield, Los Angeles, Orange County, Imperial Valley, and Salinas, Watsonville. Between Camp 1, 2, and 3, there were roughly short of 18,000 people. We became the third largest city in Arizona overnight.
Looking back now, what do you think was the hardest part, the most challenging aspect of life behind that barbed wire?
For my mother. She had very severe rheumatoid arthritis. It was hard for her to walk and all that. And everything, where you went, you had to walk. And it was very difficult for her. So that was one of the things that really was really hard to see. And, this is going back, but when my dad was taken into the different camp, he had bad asthma. And when he was taken to the camp, and he was put into tents and everything, and a lot of dust, with his weakened lung, he became sick. They didn't have the facilities to treat him in those camps, so they sent him back to our camp. We had the hospital and the facilities, so they sent him back there. But there was no transportation to go from our barrack to the hospital or things, so my mother couldn't go. So I was the only one that could go. My sister and my other brother had already gone from camp, so I would go up there, but I was underage, so I couldn't even go to the ward to see him. I had to stay outside the window from his window and talk to him through an open window. He became well, but since he came from a different camp, they wouldn't release him, and they told him that the only way they would release him to leave the hospital was to leave camp and ask me to make arrangements so that I could have my mother and father and I would leave camp and join our brother and two brothers in Colorado. Well, you know, being 17 at that time, they don't pay much attention to you. And I had a difficult time in trying to talk to the administration about leaving camp. Finally, I got it through, and then there was no, you know, we didn't have any money or anything, so they didn't have anything set up for people to leave camp at that time, so I had to ask my sister, who had gone to Des Moines to work, asked her to send us some money for a railroad fare to go to Denver, and she did, so finally got the paperwork done, and I took my mother and father out and took them to join our two brothers in Colorado. That was in 1943, and we were one of the first families to leave camp. That was prior to the opening up of the camps for all the people to leave on a voluntary basis.
That sounds really significant. And you describe all this because you lived it very matter-of-factly, but I imagine at the time, as a teenager, there were a lot of emotions wrapped up in all of this.
Yeah, you know, it's in hindsight, I can't remember a lot of the things that happened, you know, in the so many years have passed that the memory becomes blurred, but I just can't imagine how I managed to do that, what I did.
You have been declared an enemy of your own country, the country you were born in. You're locked behind barbed wire, but as a 17-year-old, you managed to talk them into letting you go and join your father and the rest of your family in Colorado, where you're not in a camp.
But the thing is, see, at the time, sentiment had changed quite a bit where they figured that we couldn't return back to the western states. Arizona we could have gone back to, but I think in California we couldn't go back yet. But then if you decided to go to Colorado, you know, you could do that, or go back east, midwest, wherever. The situation had loosened to the point where they were wanting people to leave camp. So it made it a little bit easier, but, you know, being 17-year-old, they didn't take me seriously at first.
Well, I'm sure it was really special to have that group of your family together again. But you told me something I want you to share, because I think it's pretty significant. From the time the FBI came and took your father away, your family of six, your two parents and you four siblings, the six of you were never, ever together again?
No, we never gathered as a family of six. There was always somebody missing. Primarily, I was taken to the Army. My sister was in the WACS. So we were missing. And when I came home on furlough, she was missing. When she came home on furlough, I was missing. In the meantime, my sister got married in Japan to a GI, and they were still in Japan, and he was with the occupation forces there yet. In the meantime, mother had passed away, and she was still back there. She was on the boat coming home when my mother passed, and we had to wait for her to, we had to wait 3 weeks for him before the funeral and all that. And the following year, my dad passed away, so we never got together as six ever again.
Well, and you referenced it there with your sister. And I think if, when we started this conversation, if I had said, yeah, there were four kids and two of them served in the Army during World War II, they would have assumed it was one of your brothers who was the other one. But it was your older sister. How did she end up in the WAC?
She volunteered when she was working in Des Moines. I don't know why she decided to become a WAC, but then we just got a letter from her saying that she had volunteered, and that was it.
And that's one of those things that always gets me. When I, you know, we always try to think, what would it be like to be in your shoes, to go through what you went through, that you're locked up because of what your last name is or because of what people think you look like. And your sister makes that choice. She volunteers to serve the country that's holding her family prisoner. That's a pretty remarkable choice, isn't it?
No, but you know, my dad always told us, says, you know, after the Pearl Harbor, he says, if you went back to Japan, you would be treated as an enemy because we're Americans. And if you leave this country, you'll be a person without a country. We didn't know whether the government was going to forcibly send us back to Japan or anything at the time of we were put into the camps. But my dad always says, you just don't turn your back on your country.
I know it's a long time ago. It might be hard to remember this, but do you think at the time you had a hope that this would get ironed out, that it wouldn't stay that way forever? Or was there a fear that, hey, we may be stuck in these camps forever?
Initially, there was a lot of uncertainty. But as time passed and people were being allowed to leave camp and all that, we knew that things would work out.
Well, and your sister ended up in the service, and so did you. How did you end up in the Army?
Well, when I turned 18 in 1944, in March, I signed up for the Selective Service. As soon as I got my orders to report for physical, I was still in high school. So I went to the physical and I passed. So I requested a deferment until I graduated high school, which they gave me. I graduated in June 18th, I believe. And by June 29th, they put me in the reserve. I was in the Army. I was in the reserve for 2 months until August, until they had gathered enough Japanese American to be able to form a group. And there were 105 of us in August that reported to Fort Logan in Denver. Then a few days after we were processed, we were called out, and 95 names were called out to be shipped out to go to Camp Blanding in Florida for training. And there were 10 of us left, and I was one of the 10. We don't know why we were left, but we stayed in Fort Logan there for several weeks there, not knowing what's going to happen to us. And in the meantime, you know, when the 105 of us were there, we had a lot of problems, other GIs being prejudiced, and we had a lot of fights. We figured when the 95 left, the 10 of us, we didn't know, you know, we didn't know each other, and we figured, well, we're going to be in big trouble. But, you know, nothing happened. Everybody left us alone, but we always traveled in a group of 10.
I guess, too, we should point out the irony, or certainly the contrast. Here, when you turn 18, they draft you. But just a couple years earlier, even if a Japanese American said, I want to go serve in the Army, they said, you can't. You're 4C. You're an enemy alien. Did that irony ever strike you, or were you aware of that at the time?
Oh, yes, I was. Everybody was aware of that. But then I wouldn't have volunteered. But if I were drafted, I would go willingly. I always remember what my dad says, you can't forsake your country. You have to be there for them.
And I guess I should ask you, too, had you known people maybe that you were in camp with in Poston who were already in the Army, who had volunteered to go?
Oh, yes. When President Roosevelt said that Japanese Americans could serve, and they opened up the way for the 442nd to be formed, there were three young men from our block and one from the next block, four guys that were the first volunteers from Poston. Two of them didn't pass their physical, and the two that did were from our block, and they were both put in the artillery battalion. One of them lost his leg, but they both survived. And then one of the other four eventually got drafted, and he went and joined the 442nd.
Well, and you get drafted, and by this time, the middle of 1944, have you heard about the 442nd? Have you heard stories filtering back about this gopher broke unit?
Oh, yeah. We knew that if we were in the service, that's the only outfit that we would be joining. So when I was drafted and they asked me what branch I wanted to go to, I knew that it wouldn't make any difference, but I put first choice Air Force, second choice Navy, and they didn't even look at it. They just stamped Army, and that was it was final.
Well, and again, hindsight, we know when the war ended, and we know how that all went down. But at the time, here you are, you know, you're an 18-year-old kid, a couple months in the reserves, now you're training. They send you to Camp Shelby, Mississippi, where all the 442 had trained. What'd you encounter there? What were those days like?
A lot of problems. Well, while I was training there, there was a group of veterans that came in from the Aleutians, and they really gave us a lot of trouble. They'd beat up our guards and everything, and we were going to have a confrontation with them, and our commanding officer heard about it, and he confined us to quarters, so we couldn't even leave our compound, you know. So that squelled the situation to the point where nothing happened, but there was a lot of problems.
So because they had been fighting Imperial Japan in the Aleutians, they get to Mississippi and they think you're the same as those guys, or what?
Well, we looked alike. Different uniform, but we looked alike. But then, even when you went on leave and everything, you ran into problems. A good friend of mine, when he was inducted and he had his uniform on, he said he had to run for his life because people were chasing him, you know, but things like that happened. And then we've heard stories about some of the wounded veterans that were in the hospital and got on leave. They would try to come to Mississippi, Camp Shelby, to see some of their friends, but on the way they'd get waylaid and beat up and everything. There were several instances like that, but then once you get overseas, the whole situation changed. The 442nd was noted for what they did, and people respected us, and we had never had any trouble with anybody.
He is quick to point out that he wasn't in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team for long, but long enough to wear that insignia with pride. Check out photos of Mr. Uesaka then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me.
Some hear, "It can't be done," and say, "I'll do it." Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors.
Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, "One of these days I'm going to do something with those"? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, on a weekend in which Americans of Japanese ancestry all around our country pause to reflect on what they went through during World War II. Robert Uesaka is helping all of us gain a little better understanding of that experience. Though Japanese Americans had initially been ruled unfit for service as enemy aliens classified 4C, by the time he turned 18 in March of 1944, the tune had changed. He was drafted and ended up in the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team.
My contribution was minimal, but then those that were then from the very beginning and the first replacements, they did some heroic things. Like, it's unbelievable to think that 21 of those members got the Congressional Medal of Honor. You know, they rescued a battalion of the 36th Texas Division. They were trapped by the Germans and encircled, and their own division couldn't rescue them, but they asked the 442nd to lead it, and they got broke through and rescued them. And these are the accomplishments that, I mean, you can't help but be really feel proud that they could do things like that. You know, the spirit was go for broke. That was really the spirit that people had, that they'd never back down. The irony of it is that we had more lost, killed and wounded personnel than the number that were rescued from that lost battalion.
But you're on the way overseas, and you don't know when the war is going to end. Had you ever been on a ship before, by the way?
No, you know, the first time I saw the Pacific Ocean, I saw the Atlantic Ocean before I saw the Pacific Ocean, because I lived in Arizona. But, you know, my Army career is, I was real fortunate. I was drafted in 44, but as I said before, 10 of us were left behind at the induction center. And, you know, the 10 of us in 44, it was unheard of for people to be left behind in the States so long. The bulk of the 10 of us, you know, we finished our infantry basic, and as soon as we finished our infantry basic, they didn't ship us overseas. Groups were being sent overseas all the time as replacements for the 442nd, but we never were included in those. So finally they asked us to become medics, so we went through medical basic too. So I went through two basic trainings, and consequently I stayed in the States 10 months. When I got on the ship to go overseas, the war ended before we got to Italy.
So you're on the ship and you get that news.
Yeah, we were just outside the Rock of Gibraltar there, or in the Mediterranean when the war ended.
Have you ever thought about, what if I wasn't one of the 10 that got left behind? What if I was with those other 95 that got taken?
Yeah, you know, the 95, the Battle of the Bulge was going when just before they got their training completed, they were shipped overseas right away, so they saw quite a few of the battles. And that was my group, and I missed that, so I didn't think anything of it, and I was you know, but today I was thinking how fortunate I was.
I'll spell it out, not to be master of the obvious, but of those 95 guys, there are some who were wounded badly and some who didn't come home.
Yeah. Of course, you know, most of them were strangers to me, but then that group, they're the ones that brought the colors home from Italy.
So you get there, the war's over. So you've gone through basic training, you've gone through medical training. Shouldn't be any more casualties if the fighting's over. What did they have you doing over there?
Well, when we got overseas, you know, it was the same thing when we were in Naples there, and the whole outfit shipped out to go to join the 42nd. I was left behind again. I was in the hospital. I had some kind of fever, high fever. They don't know what it was, but group shipped out, and I was the only one left behind. I had to travel by myself after I got out of the hospital and joined the outfit.
What'd you find when you got there?
Well, you know, we were newcomers, so we really didn't have to do too much. What was happening at the time was the 42nd was processing German prisoners. All the prisoners that they had captured, you know, they were trying to walk back to Germany. A lot of them, and then you had to go through their possessions and take the armament and everything away from them. And after a period of time of processing prisoners, we were put on R&R, and we went to Lake Como for R&R.
I don't want to miss anything that, you know, is relevant to you about all that, but I think one of the big questions, and maybe you can't even answer it, but when I think about the disruption to your family's life, we've already heard the six of you were never together in the same room again, lost all your crops and the 80 acres of farm that you had been leasing. And then what was the life you came back to when you got home from serving your country, when you came back home in that 442nd uniform? What next? And what did you think was next?
Well, when I got out of the Army, it was discharged. My two brothers and folks were living in Greeley, Colorado. But the weather there is, you know, it's real cold. So it was hard for my parents, who were really semi-invalids. And so we decided we'll move back to California. I got out in August of 46, and we moved back to California the following year. We wanted to settle in the Los Angeles area, but we couldn't find housing. So my two older brothers came up and down the state and found housing in Fresno. So this is how we ended up in Fresno. At that time, civil service and most of the job opportunities were closed to us, so all the thing we could do was work as farm laborers. And we did that for a year and decided we were going to sharecrop for the farm we were working on. He had grapes and plums, so we sharecropped 1 year with that. And that's when my mother passed away in the fall year. My dad passed away. My mother in 49 March, and my dad in March in 50. So we became orphans. My two older brothers, they farmed and all that. I worked as a farm laborer, and then I decided I'd take advantage of the GI Bill. So I went to school in L.A. I was working for a leather company part-time, and they wanted to open up another outlet in San Francisco. It was a wholesale leather company. They asked me if I would go up there and help open the outlet there, so I went. Then I had a girlfriend in L.A. at the time, so I asked for time off to pick her up, and we eloped in Vegas in 1952 and went back to San Francisco to live, but I couldn't find housing there except in only one district, and it was right next to a striptease thing. You could hear the drum beating. When I left, it was still in session. When I went out to get my wife, we went to Vegas to elope, and I came back a week later. It had closed down, so it wasn't so bad. But then during the course of the year, well, I found out my wife had become pregnant, so we didn't want to bring up a child in that environment, so I moved back to Fresno. There was not much job opening, so I became a gardener, and I gardened for several years and then got a landscape contractor's license, and we became landscapers.
Well, and they always say, and maybe you even heard this at the time, you shouldn't elope because it's not going to last. So how'd that work out for you?
Well, we've been married 66 years, and so we haven't scratched each other's eyes out yet, so I guess it's working out well. Four kids, no grandchildren.
I guess I should ask you how you two met. I mean, you told me you eloped to Vegas, but how did you two meet? Was it in L.A.?
Well, I was going to school there. There was a Japanese church, Union Church, that had a hostel, and they would take in students. They had a women's section and a men's section, real reasonable rates. While I was going to school, I went there, and from there, I met my wife.
I don't know if it's productive to ask this question or not, and if you don't want to answer it, feel free not to. But have you ever, over all these years, have you ever wondered how different would my life have been if they just left us alone, if they let us keep us our farm, if they didn't kick us off that land and put us in a camp?
Oh, financially, we would have been a lot better off because our parents could never own land or anything, but the children are becoming of age. And once you became of age, you can, you know, purchase land, purchase property. You had the right to vote and all that. So our family was just getting into that age bracket where my brother and sister, when the means were right, they could buy the land. And we were financially getting into that position where we could do that. The land that we were farming prior to the war, we were thinking about buying, but that went out the window. But the people that were left behind in Arizona, they all did well financially. If we had stayed there, we would have been doing as well. But then circumstances being as it was, it didn't work out that way.
What are the things you're thankful for? Obviously, that's something that some people could look at and feel resentment or feel bitterness over. I don't sense that in the way you talk about these times. What are the things that you're thankful for when you reflect back on these last 75 years?
Well, you know, with the way situation was before the war and everything, we were forced to congregate together for protection. From the advent of the war afterward and everything, of camps, people spread out all over the United States. And that opened up a new perspective for us where we became more Americanized. People began to recognize us. Everything's turned out for the better through the hardships and all that. Now, if we had stayed in Arizona, I wouldn't have met my wife. I wouldn't have my children. And I wouldn't be here today either. So, you know, everything works out well.
I know what else you wouldn't have done. You wouldn't have been able to go with your daughter on an honor flight to Washington, D.C. What was that experience like for you?
Oh, that was tremendous. You have to really appreciate efforts that went into for the people that started the honor flights, how much preparation they had, how much sweat and tears they had to put into it to allow us to be able to enjoy the trips. I went on the 5th one, and now there's going to be the 18th, which is tremendous. You know, the effort that's been put into it for us, the veterans, I really appreciated it.
I've seen a wonderful book of photos that your daughter Robin put together for you from that flight that you shared almost 5 years ago now. I know there are a lot of different things you did. What were the individual experiences or the elements of that trip that held the most meaning for you?
Seeing all the monuments, you know. And then I was fortunate, I got to see the 442nd and Kemp monument that is erected there. It's a combination of the tent internment camps that we were put in 442nd. So it's a combination of the two. But then the whole unit wasn't on the schedule. So Robin and I asked the guide that if we could break away from the group and go visit that, and we were allowed to do that. So we were thankful that they let us do that, and I was able to see that and the rest of the monuments there. I had seen some before, but then there were a lot of new ones. The Air Force, the World War II one, and the 442nd one were all new, so it was quite an experience.
And I'm just going to guess that coming back to your home for all these decades, landing in the airport and seeing a big crowd and the band playing in red, white, and blue gave you a little different feeling from 1942 when they said, get out of here. You're not really an American. We need to lock you up.
Well, you know, the things through time change. The attitudes and everything change, and you can see that today versus what it was like back in the old days. It's amazing, you know. One day, that country is your enemy, and in subsequent years, they become your friend. Human nature is funny. But I think through the efforts of what the people in the, you know, the soldiers in the MIS in the 442nd has done, you know, their efforts has made it possible for us to be recognized as people that count.
I know you like to downplay what you did, but you were in the service, and you were heading overseas, and you were part of the 442. So collectively, with all these other Japanese-American veterans of that era, do you feel like you proved something? You proved your loyalty, or you proved what you were all about?
Well, you know, I never doubted the loyalty and all that, but I think we did prove something. I'm not sure if everybody's aware of it. Even to this day, you know, there's a lot of things that it's amazing what some of the guys have done, but then nobody knows about it. It's only those that are aware of it than know about it, but the general public, they don't even know.
Some people might not know that the government eventually said, hey, we're sorry. And they probably sent you something in the mail, right?
Yeah. You know, each evacuee that was alive at the time President Reagan signed the order that each evacuee would be compensated monetarily, and we were given $20,000. I had hoped that our parents would be remembered a little bit more, those who had passed, but then that was not to be. But then it was really good to hear that they recognized that the government had done something wrong.
And then, I mean, that was for anyone who was sent to the camps. But then, just in this last decade, they said, hey, all of you Nisei veterans who served, we're giving you the Congressional Gold Medal. What did that mean?
Oh, that was special. You know, I didn't feel like so much that I deserved it, but then I was sure thankful that those that really deserved it got it, because they were tremendous. The efforts they put into it and what they had accomplished and done, it's unbelievable.
Well, I have one more question, and like I said, feel free to add anything, and I do want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story and helping us understand what you just said. A lot of people don't know. The idea of a day of remembrance, it's something that happens across our country in the Japanese-American community this time of year every year. What do we need to remember? What's important to hold on to and not let go of?
Well, you know, it's tragic that our government and our president decided to sign that order to put citizens and everybody, men, women, and children, into the camps. This day of remembrance is to let the world know that it should never happen again. It's just not right that people are subjected to such trauma, you know, that their life is uprooted and all that for no real cause. And for people to remember that it still could happen, but we hope it doesn't. And this is a reminder that it should not happen.
The bottom line from Robert Uesaka. He'll turn 93 next month in Clovis, California. Don't forget to go online to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and video related to today's episode. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
I didn't ask you about part of that experience in Washington, D.C. You mentioned going to the World War II Memorial. You go to the Japanese-American Memorial. You also went to the Vietnam Memorial. And one of those 58,000 names that's etched in black granite is actually your name. It's obviously not you, but it's the same name, Robert Uesaka. That's your cousin's son?
Yes, but see, he's Robert J. I'm Robert R. His middle name is Joseph. He was a Green Beret, loved the service, but he was caught in that Tet Offensive, and his position was overrun, and he lost his life there. But he was really gung-ho about the service, and it's too bad, but then those things happen.
I get the sense you're proud of him and his legacy.
Oh, yeah. The first thing I did when I went back there is I looked for that spot, and I etched his name, and I know exactly where it's at.